This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Interest rates on many student loans doubled July 1st. Federally subsidized Stafford loans were at an interest rate of 3.4%, but they jumped to 6.8% this month when Congress failed to agree on a plan to keep the current rates in place. Meanwhile, student loan debt in the United States is topping $1 trillion. Couple that with the fact that students are having a hard time finding jobs after graduation makes you think, is college still a good value for the money? We're going to talk about that today, and we're going to begin with Doug Letterman, who is the editor of Inside Higher Ed. It's a national publication that covers higher education. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Good to be here.
Set the picture for us. Tell us, you know, first of all, who's receiving these loans right now?
Two-thirds of students receive some kind of student loan, and about half of borrowers receive what are called subsidized loans, which are where the government pays the interest while the students are in college. And they're generally made available to students from lower-income families. There are other kinds of federal loans that are not subsidized that go to undergraduates. There are also federally guaranteed loans that go to parents and grad students. And then there's a whole set of private loans that are typically more expensive. And so we're talking about, I mean, it's a lot of students. It's millions and millions of students. And of the borrowers who have subsidized loans, or the borrowers who have federal loans, about the average debt is about a little over $26,500.
Right, and the other subsidies. So the government is paying the interest.
The interest while they're in school, right?
And then when they get out, they have essentially a lower interest rate. It's a below market rate that they're going to pay back their loan.
Well, typically, I mean historically, for about 20 years, Congress set the rates through sort of a political process, and that's how it has been up until now. And what happened in 2007, the rates were actually at 6.8%, which is what they've just gone back up to. And Congress, in a very politically popular move, cut the interest rates in half. So basically what we've just returned to is where we were 5-6 years ago. So in 2007, Congress passed a law, cut the rates from 6.8 to 3.4%, and then they were set to go back up to 6.8% last year. But last year was, yes, an election year. So they postponed, so they came up with a one-year fix, which pushed it back to this year. So all this spring, it's been clear that the rates were set to go back up to 6.8% as of July 1st. And there were various proposals from different parts of the political process, and there has been sort of a general view that the setting the rates through a political process had its flaws, as you can, since pretty much anything that's done in the political process has some flaws. But so there was there has been a prevailing view that it would be better to set them via the market, tie student loan interest rates to the financial market so that they go up and down with the economy like other forms of borrowing. But it has been impossible so far for Congress to reach agreement, Congress and the administration to reach agreement on how to do that. There are differences of opinion on that, and that's where things are hung up now.
Well, the it seems to me a benefit of a submarket interest rate would be that it makes college more affordable. I mean, is that true? How many students? Is there any way to tell how the difference between a student whether or not that interest rate made the difference for a student on whether they could afford college or not, whether they went or not?
Well, no, it's actually, I mean, there's been, we just did a piece a couple of weeks ago trying to get a sense of whether the fact that the interest rates were going back up is likely to suppress college going. And there really have not been really good studies done of that. So the answer to your question is no. I mean, there's a general sense that student loans are an important part of how our government and how we as a people finance people's higher education. We've got grants, which are significant, that don't have to be repaid. There are institutional scholarships, and there are private foundation scholarships. There are lots of ways in which people can finance their education, but student loans have become an increasingly common one, and as that debt level has started to climb, there are people who worry that it has, you know, become almost too easy to get loans, or that college, that the the availability of loans has allowed colleges to raise tuition, not indiscriminately, but maybe too easily. So, I mean, there's no question that having rates that are affordable is a good thing. Some borrowing, there's a general view that some borrowing is good for people, that it gives them skin in the game. That there are levels of borrowing where students actually benefit. But I think we're starting to have, when the average is sort of above the point at which people think that level is, and which is where we're getting to, it starts to be a problem.
But it's interesting that it suggests that the argument against the argument against keeping the interest rates low was not just from a fiscal standpoint, how much it's costing the government to do this, but whether or not it's actually good for higher education, particularly if you just allow colleges and universities to raise tuition because they say, oh, well, they can get a cheap loan. That doesn't really keep the cost down, does it?
Right. There's certainly something to that. I mean, but remember, so part of the reason, so there was a tentative deal, on this interest rate thing, but it fell apart when the Congressional Budget Office came out and said that the deal that they had struck would cost the government $22 billion over 10 years. So there's a lot of money at stake for the government as well.
Does anybody do a cost-benefit analysis, the kind of social value that might come from, you know, this kind of investment? And has it been seen as an investment socially in the sort of American infrastructure? And did anybody do that kind of cost assessment? Have you ever done that?
That's way above my pay grade. I'm not an economist, but I'm sure. I mean, you're obviously, and I think the program, the issues you're talking about in this program are really important ones, and get to much more fundamental questions about how much we value a higher education, and really what a higher education is for. I mean, I heard your teaser, and your teaser certainly suggested. I mean, people are increasingly looking at college as an investment. To help build a career. And I believe that. I've got two teenagers, or a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old almost, and I want them to come out of college with a career, but I do worry, as your teaser suggested, that if we look at college purely as that, we're going to end up shortchanging some important things that higher education does. But that's a bigger topic.
Well, it is a bigger topic, and it's one that we'll address, and we can begin right now. I mean, on the one hand, what does the idea of college as a kind of vocational project do to the notion of a liberal education? The other side of it is, if you think about it as this career path, something that's going to pay off, does it pay anymore, or is this not necessarily the best way to get a payback?
I think the main place we are, I think those questions are mostly unanswered at this point. Where I think we have unequivocally gotten to is a point at which the price of a higher education, the amount that the government is investing to in these various ways through loans and grants and all these other things to try to help students afford it, those numbers are getting so big that the questions about whether the payoff is there for individual students and whether sort of the system of higher education is delivering, we're at the point where those questions are at the surface and harder questions are being asked, and we're not going to turn back from that. Those questions are going to be addressed directly, and I don't think we have great data. And I think that there's going to be a big push to try to come up with better ways to answer those questions.
Well, tell me what you know about the rising cost of college and university education and how it compares with the cost of living in general. Because I get the sense, just from a cursory reading of headlines when these things are reported on, that higher education and healthcare are these two outliers, that the growth and the rate of cost is going up far faster than inflation in general. Am I right about that?
We've published essays and done some reporting that there are, there are lots of different ways to cut the math. But there's no question that these are, especially higher education. Higher education is a people-heavy enterprise. You know, 80% of what colleges spend to deliver the education they deliver is based on people. There's obviously equipment and there's buildings and all that, but it's a people-heavy business, and so. Higher people in higher education aren't paid as much as a lot of people, because there are some people because they it's their most nonprofit, et cetera. But it's a research is an expensive enterprise. There are a lot of things that higher education does that are expensive, and so the people in higher education, when you compare them to the regular cost, the regular consumer price index, there is a separate index that tries to measure higher education specifically, and it does rise. I mean, there's no question that it has increased faster than inflation, and it's certainly starting to outpace family incomes, which is really where the problem comes when people are when a higher education is rising faster than people's ability to pay. Obviously, that's where we get trouble.
All right. Well, Doug, thank you very much for talking with us. Doug Lederman is the editor of Inside Higher Ed. It's an online news source on higher education, a national publication out of Washington, D.C. We're going to take your phone calls this hour, 1-877-962-9862, 877-962-9862. We're going to take a break now, come back, take your calls, and talk some more about the value of a higher education. Is it worth it? Is it well-directed? And if it becomes too vocational, if it becomes a cost-benefit kind of question, what does it do to the notion of a liberal arts education? You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about higher education. Is it worth it? 877-962-9862. Costs are going up. We know interest rates on Stafford loans are doubling. Cost of higher education is getting very high, and that means colleges and universities now compete on the promise that they're going to offer better incomes for students, which means a far more directed vocational-style education. What does that do to the notion of a liberal education? All of that on the table today, 877-962-9862. David Zondervan joins me now. He's a professor of history at North Carolina State University. David, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Always good to be here with you, Frank.
We're going to talk a little bit about the history of the idea behind a university education. So tell us about this. It hasn't always been this way. How did colleges and universities begin?
Well, if you go back to the beginning, it's in medieval Europe, and universities were started to train mainly priests, gospel. But in the sort of the Renaissance era, you begin to get universities doing things like training doctors, medical doctors. In this country, the first universities get started in the 17th century. Harvard is our first one, then the College of William and Mary, and then later you get places like Yale, Columbia, Princeton. They have different names originally, but sort of the Ivy Leagues. Again, many of them training ministers first. Starting in the 18th and particularly in the 19th century, the curriculum begins to shift more toward what we consider today modern sciences. By the turn of the 20th century, you're starting to get the beginning of professional schools, law schools, medical schools, engineering schools, things
and,
of that
and who's
sort.
Going? Now, let's start with the United States and some of those first universities.
Sure.
Who's going there?
In this country, it's mainly children for families who can afford it. There aren't a lot. There's no federal loans yet and no very few scholarships. A couple of colleges. I know Harvard fairly early on would take a few what they called promising young men of limited means and try to support them to become ministers. Mm-hmm. So there was an attempt at some small amount of scholarship, but mainly well into the 19th and even the 20th century, the majority of people going to college would have been mainly the sons. Again, women's colleges get started later. It's mainly male, mainly white, mainly wealthy. No surprise there.
And relatively, in terms of expense, any way to make a comparison of sort of who could afford it and how it compares today?
Certainly, I would guess, even in real dollar terms, less expensive than today, at least at the private universities, but still out of the reach of most people well into the 20th century. It just very few people would have had any surplus income to put a son through college.
And for most of the, or at least a lot of the 20th century, certainly it wasn't an assumption, at least the first half of the 20th century, that you were going to go to college and that you had to go to college to get a good job anyway, right?
Yeah, I think I would argue it probably shifts in almost two stages, starting probably in the 1920s and 30s, among more of the middle class, there's more of the expectation that you should go to college. It's a good way to either get into the middle class or rise into the upper middle class, become more of a professional. And then after World War II, of course, with the GI Bill, that's an amazing federal investment in hundreds of thousands, millions of mainly, again, young men, but some women take advantage as well. And that's what really opens up college education to a lot of young guys who never would have thought of it. Their parents never would have thought they could afford to go to college.
Though it's interesting. I mean, I grew up in a blue-collar town, an industrial city, where sort of in the late 1960s, when I'm thinking about going to college, early 70s, there is still a robust debate in that city, and I think elsewhere in cities like it, about whether you were smarter to quit school at 18 and work at a factory where your wages were pretty darn good. And, you know, if you added it up over time, that against the debt of college, you might be better off to quit school and get yourself a job in a factory.
Right. And you're absolutely right. And I think your experience is a reflection, I think, of two premises at that time, a sort of a quote-unquote good premise and a bad premise. The good one was we did have a lot more better paying, and I might add as a labor historian, often unionized industrial jobs where a guy, again, often men, sometimes women, with not a lot of formal education, if they worked hard and had a 30 or 40-year career in a factory, could make a decent living, maybe put their children through college, have something to retire on. The other premise was the idea that if you were a working class kid, well, maybe the assumption was college isn't for you anyways, because if you're working class, you're probably not smart, because if you were smart, you wouldn't be working class. We almost kind of made that tautology a lot. A lot of teachers and a lot of guidance counselors kind of made that assumption well into the 1970s.
Well, and I think, you know, there's also a subtle fact here that the honor and dignity of work, because it was unionized and because people didn't have to apologize for it, it was seen as a kind of an equivalent profession. You could organize. You could hold your head up and say, this work is worthy of us going to a table and saying, we're worth this kind of money. And today, you know, the idea of organizing is a suggestion that somehow your work is less than somebody else.
Absolutely. And the value of I think we as a society, we make a lot of gestures to respecting the working folk, but I think absolutely manual labor, there's always been a kind of the sense of looking down, but I think that's even increased in the past couple of generations. And that's very unfortunate because
our attitudes toward union and organization are a clear indication of how little we think
about working people. Absolutely.
Well, I want to bring professor of higher education into this conversation. Now, Paul Umbach is a professor of higher education in the Department of Leadership, Policy, and Adult Higher Education at North Carolina State University. Paul Umbach, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As a professor of education, let's talk about this. I mean, what the value of a college and university education, given the cost and the payback, how do you see it, and what does your research show?
Well, I mean, if you look at the most recent data, and again, the data are probably not the most up-to-date, but if you think about the data that we look at over time, it continues to suggest that even after accounting for college costs and lost wages while in school, college graduates are going to earn more. They're also substantially more likely to be employed, almost two times as likely if you look at some data. So it does seem to suggest that there are returns on an investment in college. Of course, now with the most recent economic downturn and things like that, I think that we need to be paying attention to the data and looking to see if there's evidence to suggest that this return is decreased. But all indications, even when you start looking at 2009, 2010, suggest that it is a solid investment.
I want to go to the phones right now. Joe is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You have a question for us?
I had a comment about the first person that you had on. He was working under the assumption that student loans are necessary to go to college, and I just wanted to bring up the point that you don't need student loans to go to college. If you'll work through your undergraduate and your graduate studies, then you can pay for it yourself through proper budgeting techniques and deep sacrifice. And I'm actually a master's student right now, and I have a full-time job, and I take classes part-time, and I'm able to avoid student loans altogether. And I really think that's an important part of this discussion.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. Paul, let me ask you about that. I mean, is that possible for – would it be possible for all students? I mean, are there enough jobs or is there enough work like that available? That's the first part of that question, I guess.
I think the caller raises a good point. I mean, I think that – well, now overwhelmingly we're seeing students – this is really the first generation where overwhelmingly students are bearing the burden of financing their higher education. No generation before has seen it in this magnitude. And we're seeing the large majority of students are working while in college. Now that can be very good, and I think that there are real advantages to doing that. However, we need to consider the downsides of working maybe too much while in college. There is some evidence to suggest that students who work maybe more than 20 hours a week while in college, it does have an effect on college outcomes. But there's a financial reality here, and some students just have to do that. And I commend students that are doing that. I think it says a lot about the students and their character.
David Zonderman, historically, before this became a kind of middle class rite of passage, who was paying for it, and was there any expectation? I mean, were these parents paying for their children to go and never expecting to pay back?
Yeah, although, again, I would put it in sort of almost three phases. If you look before World War II, again, it's mainly children of upper middle class or wealthy families. Families would have paid. Again, there's the occasional story of the plucky young lad who works his way through college. But the generation after World War II and on from there, a lot of those went up with the GI Bill. But GI Bill didn't necessarily pay everything. And very often there are stories of those men and women also paying part of their college. So this generation, I think, is paying more. And I would just add, and this is purely anecdotal, Paul would know the research better than I would. But what interests me, and in fact, I've asked even our own financial aid office to do some research on this, the reasons why students work and the hours they work. And it seems to me there are some students that are on their own. There are other students whose families are struggling. But there are also two other groups of students that I find a bit troubling. I have students tell me, well, my parents have just told me they're not going to help me, even though they come from what I can understand, well-to-do families. They have beach houses, and I'm thinking, boy, there's some interesting family priorities at work there. And the other is I've got students that have told me, you know, I'm working to make car payments, and when I ask them what kind of car they drive, it's a lot better than the car I drive. Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of both personal priorities and real financial exigencies, and how we separate them. Again, I'm not an expert on the data itself. I'd like to know more about it myself, because I agree with Paul. What troubles me is that some of my students are simply working too many hours, and they're not putting enough hours then into their classwork, and they're suffering.
Let's go back to the phone. Steve is in Carrboro. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Frank. How are you today?
Good.
Interesting conversation. There's a couple of issues that I think may need to be raised. One concerns the function or purposes of higher education, and the other economic effects. So with respect to the function of higher education, you know, it's important to remember that part of the Republican tradition, especially here in the United States, is that the function or purpose of higher education was to train civic leadership and provide citizenship education for students. And I think that hasn't been sufficiently emphasized. And this actually ties into the second point about economic effects. One is that we know that business leaders today, for example, have repeatedly said in a number of studies that what they're interested in is having people who can think, who can process, who are entrepreneurial and inventive, who can write and communicate well. And those are, of course, skills that are learned in a liberal education. Moreover, if you look at the correlation between majors, for example, and jobs that people actually hold, you'll find, I think, that there's not a very strong correlation, at least with respect to a lot of leadership roles. There's not a strong correlation between the majors that people have in college and the jobs they do after they graduate,
well,
or
Steve,
later in life.
And I think you've raised two good points, but I want to leave time to get some responses. So I think the points are, you know, what are the goals of education, and are we sacrificing a kind of liberal, broad-thinking student and education for a more vocational style? And if I've got that right, I'm going to say thank you to you and try to get a response in the interest of time. So thank you, Steve. David Zonderman, again, historically, this idea of civic education, how important was that? How central was it to college education over time?
Well, I think this fundamental quote-unquote tension or dichotomy between is college for sort of this broad intellectual civic education, or is it for credentialing to get the better paying job? That debate has gone on. It's not new. I mean, I think it's highly intensified the past few years because of both political and economic shifts. but it's not new. It goes back decades, in fact, perhaps even centuries. I mean, literally, there were professors at Harvard in the 17th century complaining about their students not studying or carousing or didn't seem to be interested in the subject. All they wanted was a job. So I don't think it's all that new. I personally, and this is partly because I'm a scholar of the humanities, I am troubled that the pendulum seems to be swinging more and more right now to that side of the argument that says college, you go to college to get a good job. And I would never deny that. I mean, I'm always saying to my students, one of my goals is I'm hoping they will all get a job they want that's rewarding. But at the same time, college should not just be about vocational training. We shortchange our students. We shortchange the entire university if that's all we do. So the debate's actually quite an old one, but we seem to be veering really off the road on one side recently, and that
certainly
that
the governor me. Certainly Governor McCrory has weighed in on the side of a more vocational education. He wants to do cost benefit.
Right?
Are you paying for this thing? Is it going to get you a job? And so, Paul Umbach, I wonder if that's having pressure, putting pressure on the universities because of the pressure families are feeling. Do they feel the need to begin to shape their programs sort of more on this? I would call it on a vocational model. Is that happening?
Well, I think the conversation is happening in families and in individual students are considering this as they weigh the cost benefits of their education, as they try to decide what they're going to be doing after college and whether their investment in time and in money and lost wages is going to be, you know, going to be paid back. But I think the point that's raised that's really important is to consider this balance of public and private benefits in that debate that David was talking about. I think we often overlook kind of the public benefits, or of late, public benefits have kind of been pushed aside, and I think it's important to maybe have a conversation about that in the public. We talk about greater productivity. If we have an educated workforce, greater productivity, greater education. Economists have found that they're, you know, college-educated folks are more likely to vote, more likely to volunteer. They're more healthy. They pay more taxes. So, I mean, there are real benefits to society at large of having a college-educated citizenry. That are often, you know, we underestimate these, I think, sometimes.
Well, let's go to Chapel Hill. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but let's go to Chapel Hill. Chris is on the line. Chris?
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about higher education as a business, specifically online universities that essentially make their money by cajoling people who either aren't ready for college or shouldn't be in college and making their money off really the government in terms of, you know, in the form of student loans.
All right. You're talking about for-profit universities as well? Is that part of the question?
For-profit universities as well, specifically online universities.
And online universities. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. Well, Paul, let me start with you on that one.
That's an interesting point. I recently was I'm visiting family in the Virginia Beach area, and I was driving around, and I noticed there was a sign out for a college that said ECPI is the best for vets, for veterans. And, you know, there's a lot of veterans down here in the Virginia Beach area. So I think there is a real marketing, and they see the GI Bill and the post-9/11 GI Bill as a real way to garner revenue. And ECPI is a for-profit institution. And they have their place in the higher education system. But there is some conversation to be had about what it means to go to these institutions. And they target low-income students, which is something to consider. I mean, who are we targeting and what are they doing with the money, and what happens with these students once they finish?
So more monitoring and accountability on their part. But even the universities, nonprofit universities in general, let me ask this question. Do subsidies make them less responsive to the market, not just in terms of getting you the job at a high rate of pay afterward, but in just keeping up with the times? Can a university afford, because of subsidies, because of subsidized payments, not to pay attention to the real needs of the students? We hear about the disconnect between majors and jobs. Well, does this tell you that universities aren't keeping up? And maybe it's because they're subsidized, David?
Well, I guess I'd say two things. One is I want to reiterate what Paul said earlier about the sort of the public benefits, particularly of public investments in public universities. And again, this is probably a subject for a whole nother show, but that's part of a much broader trend in the past 10 or 20 years to sort of leave out public value from much of our even political conversations. And I guess I'm naive enough to believe that politics ought to be about some discussions of public values, not just what's good for private individual benefit. And there are many, many, many tangible benefits. The second point is, again, the subsidies support all kinds of parts of what a university does. And I guess I'm of the opinion that universities on one level certainly need to be responsive and listen to students, and we certainly shouldn't and can't educate students the way we did it 50 or 100 years ago. But on the other hand, I think there are certain core values of universities and certain core pedagogical ideals, things like I think there's still great value in small seminars for certain subjects at certain levels. I don't think everything can be taught online. I don't think everything can be done in a 500-person lecture class. So even though they may be, quote-unquote, more efficient. So business models, I think the whole for-profit university world is a whole other almost universe. But I'm talking about even public universities themselves. Certainly we need to be good business people, good custodians of the public fisc, as they say. We're getting public money, and we ought to be transparent. We ought to use it well. But that's not quite the same thing as saying we should run NC State or Chapel Hill or App State or anywhere the way Nabisco runs or Mobil runs. And so that corporatization and business model has real dangers in it.
On the State of Things Today, the value of a higher education. David Zondervan, professor of history at North Carolina State. Paul Umbach is an associate professor of higher education at NC State as well. More of your calls and this conversation when our program continues, 877-962-9862. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking about higher education today. Is it still worth it? David Zondervan is a professor of history at NC State. Paul Umbach is an associate professor of higher education in the Department of Leadership, Policy, and Adult Higher Education at NC State. And joining us now is Lindsay Moriarty. She is the owner of Mo Nuts Donuts in Durham. And Lindsay, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
So your role in this whole question of higher education is that you did not go a traditional route. And while you have a higher education, it is not in donut making. So maybe you can tell us your story and how you got to start what appears to me to be a very successful business here in Durham.
Sure. So I went to undergrad in North Florida in anthropology. It was one of those fields that I was warned against. I heard you guys talking about college being a vocational training center, and anthropology definitely is the one that they're like, what are you going to do after you graduate? And my answer was, I'm going to go back to school. Right. So I moved up to North Carolina with the intent of applying to graduate schools, but hopefully getting into UNC, which I did. I went there for a dual degree program in public health and city and regional planning with a focus on health disparities and economic development. And when I graduated, I couldn't find a job.
So I'm going to stop you right there because you had a plan. You're not just going through to get a degree.
Right.
And give us an idea what your vision was for this degree, what you were going to do with it.
Sure. So I was interested in health disparities and particularly how they were affecting, poor people in the United States. I think it's easy to look at health as a product of what you eat, donuts or that, but it's also a product of poverty and what kind of jobs people have, how are they able to provide for themselves healthfully. And the more I thought about that kind of intersection, the more interested I was in how interventions were being planned to improve health disparities in the United States. And so with that as the premise, that's what I wanted to go to school for. I figured if I had, there was this program at UNC that combined these two fields, it seemed perfect. And so that's what I did. And my idea was I wanted to be in practice. I didn't want to be in academia, but I knew that the two were connected. And it seemed to me, or at least from who I was talking to, that if I wanted to be kind of an expert in this field, I had to have educational credentials in my background to make that transition back into practice.
So you get out. It's a great plan. You've thought it through. And it's a kind of a market decision, right? There is a problem, and you've identified it,
right.
And you're now going to put yourself on the front lines,
right.
Make a career of fixing it. So those are all good business decisions as well as conscientious, soulful thoughts about your place in the world. You get out, and there's no job. What do you do now?
I went to Greece. I was so confident I would get a job.
That's perfect because nobody's working there either.
Yeah, lots
Way
of jobs
go.
In Greece.
All right.
I was so sure I would get a job. I was like, I'm going to go on vacation. I'm going to celebrate this great accomplishment. I was going to come back and have these job offers waiting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't the case. I feel like I was unemployed for about 4 months before Monuts really started to take its footing and like as something I could actually do. And I remember just like waking up and it'd be like, what are you going to do today? Look for jobs. And you do just reach that point where you're like, I don't know what other jobs I can apply for. Yeah. You know, like you just feel like you reach the end of the internet, the end of the classifieds.
Tell us about the donut making. When did that enter the picture?
So during grad school, ironically, my sort of inside joke with one of my groups of friends was, what are you going to do if you dropped out of school today? You know, like, what's your ultimate plan B? And for me, it was starting a bakery. And so the concept of Monuts, like, we already had it named. We had all these different ideas for it. I had a donut journal. I mean, it was ridiculous, but it was always a joke. And so,
but you were making donuts for friends who could validate your skill as a donut baker.
Right.
A baker,
right? For Sunday brunches, I would bring donuts. For one of my capstone projects, I would always bring donuts to team time or meetings. Mm-hmm. And so it was just something I did. It's like, I don't know that I was doing it with the end goal being like, oh, one day I'm going to need this donut making skill. But it was fun. It was a hobby for me. And then when I had reached that point where I needed to get a job, start making money one way or the other, a bunch of like very fortuitous things just sort of happened with the cookery opening up in Durham being a place where you could, you know, start a small food business.
The commercial kitchen and the cookery. Yeah.
Right. And then one of my friends found like this giant yellow tricycle ended up on my front porch. And I'm like, well, I could sell donuts off of that. and then I think in Durham specifically, food, it was just taking off, like food, entrepreneurship, innovation, all these topics were kind of just spiraling and people loved it. And so it seemed like something that I could latch onto, at least temporarily, until I found that job that I was looking for. And so that's when I started making donuts at the cookery. I would sell on Saturdays at the farmer's market. I was kind of like a food truck, but not really. But they let me pretend I was a food truck, so I got to go to those sorts of events.
You were a food trike.
That's right. That's
pretty
right.
Good, yeah.
I was a food tricycle.
And you did so, and you build this base of support, and people are all asking you when you're going to go brick and mortar,
right.
And you do, and you've got a successful business. So I want to stop you there because
sure.
I know the story goes on. But and you did ultimately get a graduate degree. Did you finish grad school?
I did. I got 2 master's degrees.
All right. So you went to school, and it's not as though you didn't finish, but obviously your degree is not in what you're doing now, and it's a successful business. You're
mm-hmm.
doing well?
Yes.
So let me ask you, David, the first question I have is there is a need. So in terms of if all you ask about college is we want this to be market-oriented, Lindsay goes to school saying there are health disparities in this country. People are suffering because they don't have the right access, and there are a variety of reasons for it. Let me study it and put myself on the front lines. Gets out and finds there's no job. So right away, there's a market mismatch, but the market isn't because the universities aren't turning out good students. Somehow, the capital, right, who's going to pay for Lindsay's expertise? That has to be a public expense. And since that's shrinking, right, I mean, who else is going to pay for Lindsay to go fix poor people's, you know, health disparities? It seems to me that if you're blaming the university for not having a job for Lindsay, maybe you're putting the blame in the wrong place. Why isn't there public money available to pay for people who are addressing what is clearly a market demand?
Well, that was actually as Lindsay was talking, I had 2 things in my mind. The first one was exactly what you just said, is what's happened to you is a reflection of how screwed up some of our decisions in public – where we're spending our public money is, that we as a society, where we know we have these enormous economically based health disparities in our country, we're not doing enough to deal with them. We ought to have 50 people like Lindsay dealing with it. So that was my first reaction. And the second was, and maybe Lindsay, you can speak to this, and I'm hoping you'll give one good answer, but even if it's the other, I can live with it. Looking back on all your education, your training, even what you're doing now, do you regret it? Do you say, gee, I wasted all those years doing anthropology and public health, and I just should have at age 18 found some buddies to make donuts and saved myself all that money and heartache or whatever?
Right. I like to think of it that I took the scenic route to getting to donut making, and I don't regret it. I think that I met an incredible group of people, and I think I have a kind of a social network, you know, having friends that are lawyers and business advisors. They're all people that I met in grad school. Even my faculty have been super supportive of me as I've started a business. And I still think that the issues that I was passionate about in school have, at least in my case, and I know I run kind of a unique operation, but they've translated to now I'm a small business owner, and there's certain issues that are relevant, like having service industry employees, and am I offering a living wage, benefits, things like this that do play into health disparities and the same sorts of things that I was looking at through an academic lens previously.
And you do offer benefits.
I do.
And you have to wonder how much your heart and soul may be there to begin with, but how much an academic training to open your eyes to the importance of something like offering benefits and a living wage might be. I mean, those things do contribute to how you conduct your successful business. Because you can make even more money if you had an unemployment rate of 9% not offering those things.
Right.
So you've made a choice to cut your profit, and yet it's hard to get into that place, I have to say. Paul, let me ask you that question again, that kind of market question. I mean, maybe we've answered it, but it does seem to be unfair to place that burden on universities when there's quite a demand for what universities teach. It's just that the public doesn't seem to want to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's – well, before I start, I want to say selfishly, I'm pleased that Lindsay found a way to mow nuts.
Exactly.
And I speak probably on behalf of a lot of people in Durham and the Triangle area. It's the great donuts. Thank you, Lindsay. I think what's interesting in hearing Lindsay talk, and I think it leads back to some of the stuff Dave was saying, is that it's a college education likely attempt that prepares folks to be somewhat nimble as they're thinking about their careers. That, you know, they develop a variety of skills that maybe higher education isn't so great at measuring and communicating to the public. That prepares them to do a variety of things. Critical thinking, writing, or things like Lindsay's suggesting. I mean, these connections that she's made and the different skills and the values that she developed over time, I think are really valuable job skills and career skills and life skills that maybe higher education doesn't do a great job communicating.
Let's go to the phones now. Bob is on the line from Willow Spring. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob. Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to add a comment, if I might. I've been in higher education publishing for a number of years, and I wanted to go back to something the gentleman said a number of minutes ago regarding the cost of higher education and relating that to it being people-heavy, and that's why one of the reasons why the cost is so high. And if I might say that I think we have to look at the instructors in that regard. I'm on campus every day during the semesters, fall and spring, and I can't tell you how many professors I've talked to over the past number of years who look at their position just as a job. They don't necessarily want to be there. They're not engaged. Consequently, their students are not engaged. They're not excited about going to class. Some of them have tenure who are not teaching classes at all during the semester, maybe just one, maybe two. And I think if we start weeding out those individuals and looking at that as a problem like any corporation would, and seeing how we can best rectify that situation, I think the costs might start coming down because the salaries obviously will not be there, and that aspect of being people heavy will be alleviated.
Well, thank you, Bob, for that call. I mean, I wonder how much of that is unique to the university. I mean, obviously, there are people working everywhere who aren't passionate about what they're doing, and maybe that's sort of part of the problem, too, is that you know, Lindsay, you were able actually to pursue your passion, which is, and not that the public health job wouldn't have been great for you, but let me ask this question in a different way. The sense that how much of a sense did you have growing up that you more or less had to go to college, that it was never a question for you that you were going to college?
It was never a question. I mean, yeah, my parents said you're going to college, and from the time I was little, I knew I would be going to college.
So if you wanted to express to them, and I'm not saying they're unreasonable people, but if you wanted to say, you know, Dad, I want to make donuts.
He would have been pretty upset with me.
Right. I mean, it does raise a question. I mean, I'll let you, Paul, maybe answer that question about the dead wood at universities. Is that unique to universities?
Well, I don't want to sound self-serving in any way, I think, in some ways, but I've done some work on college faculty, and I think we have to be careful about making generalizations about a few. I mean, on average, college faculty, if you look at most research, they're working 50, 60 hours a week, which is, which is not uncommon, and I think when we talk about college faculty teaching one or two courses, there's also a lot of them are on grants and doing a whole bunch of other things, administrative tasks. So I think we have to be a little careful about generalizing when we think about college faculty. And the idea of deadwood, of course, I mean, I think that that's not isolated to higher education and college and universities. I think that that's something that you would see in any industry.
But inherent in that, too, is this question of passion. And I wonder if you think about the way universities are structured and, again, our expectations, middle class expectation that you're going and the way universities are structured, you know, and classes and courses are taught in silos, whether we need to be rethinking that to allow for these kind of passionate flows to be part of the mix, both for the faculty and for students. Paul, have you thought about that? And is that something that's kind of, you know, kind of on the minds of scholars of education?
I mean, I think that, you know, most scholars are passionate about the work that they do. And, we get a good deal of autonomy, and that allows us to kind of move in directions where we feel passionate. And I think when we talk about higher education, there's a breadth of higher education. I mean, if we can even think about community colleges and, you know, the college faculty there that in the state of North Carolina are teaching 5 or 6 classes a semester and are highly committed to teaching and working hard. And we have a wonderful community college system in the state that staffed by great faculty and staff that are passionate about teaching. So I think that it's not to suggest we shouldn't be thinking about ways to innovate and things like that, but I think that there are real strengths in some of the things that we do already across the system of higher education.
And one of the things we haven't talked about, and David, I know that you're a professor in the humanities, but the amount of primary research that's done at universities that private industry will not undertake. It is too costly, and it may go nowhere. All of that subsidized by student loans and tuition itself. The whole education system promotes that kind of thing.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that, I think one of the themes that's been running through, I think, this whole day is what troubles me a lot with this debate that's going on now is we're falling into a lot of very short-term thinking and not doing much long-term thinking. And I'll very quickly make a couple examples. One is the whole idea of loans and investment. You're going to take out many students will take out student loans. You're not going to pay them, you will not make a profit off that, quote unquote, in a year or maybe even 5. But if you're talking about a 40-year career, and again, Paul knows the data better than I do, most college students, even if they take significant loans, will make more than non-college students and over their career will make more money. But they're not going to see it the first year. They got to think long term. And the second way is the whole attitude of education. You know, one of the big problems I have with this push of we should be educating students for the jobs of today, one of the big problems is, and again, I know a bit about this because I study labor markets a little bit in the history of labor. Labor markets change often annually or 5 and 10 years. So if we take a freshman today and say in 4 years you're educated for the job of today, 4 years or 5 years from now, there may be less jobs of that. So that's where a liberal arts education gives you skills for a lifetime. Critical thinking doesn't go out of style. Good reading, good writing, good thinking, the ability to research, use data. I don't see any of those ever, quote unquote, going out of fashion. They may be used in different careers. So that's something I've been talking a lot about this with people. Think long term.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. David Zondervan, a professor of history at NC State, Paul Umbach, associate professor of higher education at NC State, and Lindsay Moriarty, who is the owner of Monuts Donuts here in Durham. Thank all of you for being on the program today. And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.